So I wonder this morning if any of you here have ever researched or had research done on your family tree. Anybody here had any of that done? Did you find anything interesting in that process? Yeah, some nods. Any surprises? None you want to share, right? Yeah. They say that if you're like most people, then you probably have relatives in your family tree that you'd rather not talk about. And I mean not just the nuts and saps that collect in most trees, but people that when you're drawing out your family tree, you're tempted to use whiteout on them, right? The fact is, we don't like to talk about, you know, the horse thieves and the crooks, maybe even shady politicians that we find there, right? Thomas Fuller once said, "He that has no fools, knaves, nor beggars in his family must have been begot by a flash of lightning." And you know, in many cases, families often try to sanitize their past. Ever notice that? Except, I'm told, people from Australia who seem quite proud of their criminal heritage of their country. If you didn't know, between 1788 and 1868, that's where England shipped their criminals. And that's basically how the country of Australia was settled. You knew that, right? Some of you? Yeah. But I hear lately that's become a little bit of a status symbol. I was reading an article, and apparently to the Aussies, if your ancestors arrived in Australia in chains, that's apparently something to brag about these days. So there you go. And if you think about it, it seems a little kind of weird, right? Not now, but in about 6 months from now, sometime in February, when we're buried up to our noses in snow and the mercury has frozen to the bottom of the thermometer, I want you to think about the fact that people settled Canada, but they had to be sent to Australia as prisoners. Like, go figure, right? During the last several months, we've been looking at a number of different Bible characters. We've been looking at people just like us. People who were facing impossibilities, sometimes impossible odds, roadblocks, threats, pitfalls, often uncertainties. People who were at the crossroads in their lives in some form or another. People like Joseph, whose life was the pits in more than one way. Elijah, Jeremiah. We looked at people like Daniel, who lived out an uncompromised life, even though there were consequences. Or what about his buddies, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who were willing to face fiery flames of opposition? We looked at a number of characters in the New Testament, like the woman who showed up at Simon the Pharisee's house, or that paralyzed guy who had at least four good friends who were bound and determined to bring him to Jesus. We looked at an amazing, impossible situation that Jesus' disciples faced one day when they were asked to feed a bunch of people who were hungry. Last week, we looked at a guy who had been an invalid for 38 years, hanging around the pool of Bethesda, who one day was asked by Jesus, "Would you like to be healed?" And in each of these situations, the goal was to see what God was doing. The goal was to see how God was moving and working in their lives to bring about life change, and then how we could apply those same life lessons to our own situation. This morning, I want to look at yet another character whose life can only be chalked up to grace. God's grace. By the way, let me ask you a question as we get started. How would you define grace? How would you define grace? What is grace? Unmerited favor. I like that answer. Yeah? Okay. You think grace is mercy? I'll get to that in a moment. Okay. The Oxford Dictionary defines grace as, okay, you must have, you know, got that dictionary in your head, the free and unmerited favor of God as manifested in the salvation of sinners and the bestowing of blessings. Now, some time ago, I gave you a rather sort of a pithy definition of how to keep some of those terms straight that sometimes we intermingle, okay? And I'm going to give it to you again because it'll make a lot of sense to be able to see it. Justice is getting what you deserve, right? If you break the law and you have to go to court or pay a fine, that's justice, right? You're getting what you deserve. Mercy is getting less than what you deserve. And grace is getting what you don't deserve. All right? If you want to pen those down, we'll leave that on the board for a bit, because that's a great way to just sort of keep those terms straight in our head. Bob Goff, author of Love Does, describes a great definition of grace. He says, grace is a painting God is in the process of completing over a torn canvas. Any painters here? If you are a painter, or if you've ever tried painting, you know it's important to have a canvas that has been properly prepared. I remember taking a number of fine arts courses where we were taught how to make sure our canvas was made properly. But grace is God in the process of completing a painting over a torn canvas. And I believe that's true for each one of us. In fact, that's more true probably than most of us would care to admit. And like I said earlier this morning, I want to look at another Bible character. I want to take a look at another snapshot of a life. And this one is a picture of grace found in a most unlikely place, a brothel. By the way, in case you haven't noticed, not too many stories in the Bible start in a house of ill repute. But before I try to unpack the story, before we meet the character, I want you to know that this whole situation, this whole story is summed up in one verse in God's Faith Hall of Fame. If you have your Bible this morning, I want to invite you to turn to that one verse in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11. In Hebrews chapter 11, verse 31, we read these words. It was by faith that Rahab the prostitute was not destroyed with the people in her city who refused to obey God, for she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. Now, what exactly does that mean? She had given a friendly welcome to the spies. Well, before you jump to any conclusions, let me remind you of something somebody once said. The only thing you get from jumping to conclusions are sore feet. Okay? Now, to be fair, Rahab may have given the spies a friendly welcome, but that wasn't what she was being commended for in Hebrews 11. And in order to discover that, we have to go back to the beginning and find out the rest of the story. Keep your finger in Hebrews chapter 11, and then turn back to the book of Joshua, chapter 2, where this story takes place. Most of you know the history here. Moses had led the Hebrews in the greatest escape ever chronicled. We read about it in the book of Exodus. Only what should have been a fairly straightforward trip across the desert turned out to be a 40-year epic because of the disobedience and unbelief of the Hebrew people. But finally, the promise is about to be fulfilled. The promised land lies just beyond their grasp. The people have left the desert. Now all they have to do is cross the Jordan and get past the city of Jericho. So what happens? We'll take a look at what happens in Joshua chapter 2. We read in Joshua chapter 2, beginning with verse 1. Then Joshua secretly sent out two spies from the Israelite camp at Acacia Grove. He instructed them, scout out the land on the other side of the Jordan River, especially around Jericho. So the two men set out and came to the house of a prostitute named Rahab and stayed there that night. Now, at first glance, the guys that Joshua sends out don't seem all that focused on their mission. At first glance, these two men set out on a fact-finding journey, and it seems like immediately they end up at the house of a prostitute. Now, to be fair, a brothel was a place where strangers could show up at all hours without raising any suspicion. And for whatever reason, these hand-picked spies who had been selected for a specific mission ended up at Rahab's place. Unfortunately for them, we discover in this passage that word had gotten around to the king of Jericho that spies had entered the land. And so he immediately sends his men to Rahab's place. The king's men, they show up at this brothel, but Rahab tells them, oh, those guys, yeah, they were here earlier, but they left. In fact, she says they're headed out of town, but if you hurry, you can still catch them. And we're left with the impression that the king's men obviously believed her because they quickly get a posse together and they head out of town after them. But this is where the plot thickens. You see, the guys the king's men were looking for hadn't actually left. Rahab had hidden them on the roof of her place, and it was there that they spent the night. And as a reward for her saving the spies, they agreed to spare her and her family when the Hebrews eventually overthrow the city on their way to the promised land. And that's a whole other story that's mentioned in the previous verse in Hebrews chapter 11, and a story that you probably first heard in Sunday school, if you didn't, flip back to Hebrews 11 just for a moment, because the book of Hebrews chapter 11, verse 30, recaps it by saying this. The writer of Hebrews says, it was by faith that the people of Israel marched around Jericho for 7 days and the walls came crashing down. And as you may remember, it was on that day, in the heat of the battle, that Rahab hangs a scarlet cord from the window of her home, and she and her family were saved. So what is it that we can learn from this story? How could this story possibly give us a snapshot of grace? Look again at verse 31, Hebrews chapter 11. It was by faith that Rahab the prostitute was not destroyed with the people in her city who refused to obey God, for she had given a friendly welcome to the spies. So first of all, Rahab had a past. She had a past. I got to tell you, it was interesting as I was preparing this message how hard some commentators tried to clean up Rahab's past. In fact, one of them had this to say. He says, the word which we translate harlot or prostitute should be rendered innkeeper or tavern keeper, as there is no proper evidence that the person in question was such a woman as our translation represents her. As to having been a harlot before and converted afterwards is a figment of an idle fancy. I got news for you. Have you ever noticed that God's word doesn't try to whitewash its characters? They're presented just like they are. Today, she might have been called a sex worker. But no one would have mistaken her for the manager of our local Best Western. John Wesley used a great phrase to describe Rahab. He writes, "Formerly one, not of the fairest character." Now, it's easy to cast stones, right? It's easy to wonder, how could this woman sell her body like that? Whatever brought her to the place to become a prostitute? But you see, Rahab had a past. And there are some people who would be quick to scorn her. Others would pity her, but the reality is we don't know why she was what she was. All we know is that she had a past. She had a past. She obviously had a story that had brought her to this place in her life. And since we don't know her backstory, it really isn't fair to judge her past. The reality is that every one of us has a past. And I'll bet there isn't a person here who would want all of their past revealed. On the other hand, you look like nice people, most of you. Probably for the most part, your past is spotless, and you never did anything to be ashamed of. But I suspect if you got up tomorrow morning and somebody had left a note posted on your door that said, "I know what you've done," your mind might jump to some incident or some situation, and you might wonder, how could they possibly know about that? And you might wonder, are they going to tell anyone else? Maybe it was something you did as a child. Maybe something you did while your brain took a nap during your teen years. Perhaps it was just a thought, a moment of indiscretion, but it's there. And even though nobody else or very few people know about it, you do. I've come to the conclusion that nobody should be judged by the worst moment in their life. Because the reality is, it's easy to cast stones. In fact, listen to what Jesus had to say about that in Matthew chapter 7, verse 3. He said, "Why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own?" I remember an incident in the Gospel of John, and maybe you do too, when on one occasion a crowd of people had gathered around a woman who had been caught in the act of adultery. And the people who were present that day were eager to judge her. They were eager to take things in hand. They were quick to condemn her. They were in a hurry to render a verdict of guilty and render subsequent punishment. And with all of the people clamoring to do something, here's Jesus, unhurried, unharried, untroubled, unruffled, undisturbed, unflustered, unfazed, looking at all of the people while he was scribbling in the sand. And he says in John chapter 8, verse 7, "He who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first." And the Bible tells us that in a heartbeat, the crowd dispersed. The crowd faded away. They scampered off. They hastily withdrew. Somebody once said that there are two mistakes that we make about our past. The first one is to forget about it. We deal with an issue in life and then we forget about it, and suddenly we have little or no sympathy for those who are struggling with that same issue that we just got over. Sort of like the ex-smoker who has little or no sympathy for those who are still struggling with that habit. You see, they've forgotten the cravings and the desires that went along with the addiction that they faced earlier, and they're quick to say stupid things like, "Why don't you just quit?" Forgetting the 247 times they tried to quit before they got it right. So that's the first mistake, to forget about it. The second mistake that we make about our past is not forgetting it, right? In other words, we can't help but dwell on it. We can't get over it. And so over and over, we relive that event of the past in our minds. we can't forgive ourselves for those mistakes or that mistake that we've made. And so invariably, we spend the rest of our lives bogged down in the muck and mire of our past, saying things like, if only I had done this or that differently. If only I had another chance at that. If only I would have made this or that decision back there. If only I had my life to live again. Canadian writer Thomas H. Rattle once said, don't brood on the past, but don't forget it either. You see, everything that happened up to a minute ago is part of your past, and you can't change it. You can't undo it. You simply need to accept that it happened and learn from it. And that's exactly where we find Rahab, standing at the intersection of her life. In Rahab's situation, her past was behind her and her future was ahead of her. And she had to decide what part of her past she was going to embrace and what part of her past she was going to reject. Because not only was part of her past made up of Rahab the prostitute, but part of her past was also made up of Rahab the virgin. In other words, there was a time in her life when she wasn't what she had become. You know, the same is true for all of us, isn't it? When we look backwards, when we look into our past lives, we're overcome with shame, but that wasn't always the way it was. And that isn't the way it has to stay. So first, Rahab had a past. She had a past, just like you do, and just like I do. Second, Rahab had a choice. She had a choice to make. We read in Joshua chapter 2, verse 2, that the king of Jericho was told that spies had arrived in his city, and he makes the logical leap that they were at Rahab's house, and before too long, his men arrive at that place, and they demand that Rahab surrender those spies. Now, at this point, Rahab has to make a decision. The question is, what would she do? Would she do what was easiest, or would she do what was right? You know, I wonder this morning, have you ever been in a situation where you've had to make a choice? Where you could choose between doing what came easiest or where you had to choose to do what was right? Rahab had to make a decision. She could choose to do what came easiest or what was easiest, or she could do what was right. But it was more complicated than that, because even in that, there were issues, right? You see, as a citizen of Jericho, what was right was different than what was right for those two Hebrew spies. The point I'm trying to make here is that, contrary to what some people will tell you, not every issue is black and white. Not every issue that you're going to face in life is right or wrong. And in case you haven't noticed, there are issues that will divide people. Where one side will think you did a great job and will congratulate you and will put up monuments in your honor, while on the other side, there will be a lineup of people that can't wait to spit on that same monument. To the Hebrews, Rahab was a hero. But to the people of Jericho, she became a traitor and worse. So what did Rahab decide? Well, she decides to hide the spies. And then she lies to the authorities before sending them on a wild goose chase. And you have to ask the question, why did she do what she did? Why did she take the chance that, if discovered, would have cost her her life? Why did she start down the path of no return? By the way, when you read this account, I get the impression that even those spies who had been hidden on her rooftop, who were lying under piles of flax, were wondering the same thing. They had no idea how this would end. They had no idea how this would ultimately pan out. But I get the impression that when they heard the footsteps approaching their hideout, they were probably wondering if she was alone or if she had changed her mind and what their future would be like, or even if they had a future. But there's something I need to point out here. You see, it wasn't the fact that Rahab had defied the king's men that got her mentioned in the book of Hebrews. It was why she defied the king's men that got her mentioned there. Because after she had sent the authorities on that wild goose chase, Rahab went up on the rooftop to let the spies know that they were in the clear. And then she explains to them why she had saved them. In fact, take a look at the passage. Her explanation begins in Joshua chapter 2, beginning with verse 9. Rahab says to the men, "I know the Lord has given you this land. Oh, and by the way, we are all afraid of you. Everyone in the land is living in terror. For we have heard how the Lord made a dry path for you through the Red Sea when you left Egypt. And we know what you did to Sihon and Og, the two Amorite kings east of the Jordan River, whose people you completely destroyed." Verse 11, "No wonder our hearts have melted in fear. No one has the courage to fight after hearing such things." Now listen to what she says. She says, "For the Lord your God is the supreme God of the heavens above and the earth below." You see, Rahab had a choice. And at that point, she came to the place where she was willing to leave her past and her baggage behind her and claim and believe in the promises of God. Listen up, no matter what has happened in your past, no matter what sorts of things you have experienced in this life, the future still stretches out before you. And this morning, God is inviting you and me to step into it with Him. There's a very interesting thing that happens in the book of Joshua. It's worth looking at. You see, right at the very end of this book, we read about the people of Israel who are preparing to finally settle down into the land that God had promised to them a long, long, long time ago. It had been a long journey. It had cost them a lot. There were some very hard lessons that they had learned along the way. It hadn't been a cakewalk. The people were tired out. They were completely worn out. But before this event takes place, Joshua calls all of the people together and he issues an incredible challenge to all the people gathered there. In fact, keep your finger in Joshua chapter 2 and flip right to the end of the book. In Joshua 24, verse 15, Joshua is addressing all of the people and he says to them, he says in verse 15, "But if you refuse to serve the Lord, then choose today whom you will serve. As for me and my family, we will serve the Lord." You know something? That day when Joshua issued that challenge, we know that Rahab had already aligned herself with the Hebrew people, and she was part of that crowd that heard Joshua's words. Listen, in more ways than one, this morning, you and I are standing on the same threshold. This morning, we're facing the same question that Joshua issued to the people of Israel. Whom are you going to serve? What are you going to serve? In the days that will make up the rest of your life, are you going to continue to serve the past? Or if I can put it another way, are you going to be content to continue to wallow in the shortcomings of your past? Or are you ready to step through the door into the incredible future that God has for you through His grace? It's your choice. It's your call. It's your decision. Somebody once said, "Losers live in the past, winners learn from the past, and enjoy working in the present toward the future." So number one, Rahab had a past. Second, Rahab had a choice. But not only that, Rahab also had a future. She had a future. You know the rest of the story. The Israelites capture the city of Jericho. They march around the city for 6 days, and then on the seventh day, they blow their horns, they shout, and God brings down the walls of the city. And Rahab, who had hung a scarlet cord from her window as a predetermined arrangement, was spared along with her family. Now, the story could have ended there, and we would be none the wiser. The story could have ended there, and we would probably say things like, all's well that ends well. The story could have ended here, and Joshua and the people of Israel could have settled the promised land. This story could have ended here, and Rahab could have gone back to doing what she was doing before, providing a friendly welcome for people. But that's not how the story ends. Look at the passage. In fact, flip over a few pages from Joshua chapter 2, because I'm going to pick up the story in Joshua chapter 6. In Joshua chapter 6, verse 25, we read these words. So Joshua spared Rahab the prostitute and her relatives who were with her in the house, because she had hidden the spies Joshua sent to Jericho, and she lives among the Israelites to this day. And then we hear nothing about Rahab for the next 1,000 years. Nothing. Nada. Zip. But suddenly she reappears out of nowhere. We meet Rahab in the most unlikely place you would ever imagine. We meet Rahab in the genealogy of Jesus. Go figure. This is important. Take a moment and turn to Matthew chapter 1. This is usually a chapter that we like to skip because all we have is a bunch of long names and hard to pronounce names, and so we think, oh, it's just a genealogy. No problem. Let's just skip over to the story, right? Maybe you've done that. Maybe you work your way through all the names. But listen to what we read in Matthew chapter 1, verse 5 and 6. Solomon was the father of Boaz, whose mother was, there's her name. Boaz was the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed was the father of Jesse. Jesse was the father of King David. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother was Bathsheba, the widow of Uriah. Now, did you catch that? In an incredible turn of events, Rahab the prostitute became the great-grandmother of King David, the greatest king who ever ruled over Israel. And ultimately, at the very end of that list was Joseph. You know who I mean. Joseph, the guy who married the Virgin Mary and who raised the Lord Jesus as his own son. In other words, get this. If it weren't for Rahab, there'd be no Boaz, right? You may remember that Boaz was the man who married the widow Ruth. In fact, that's an entire book in the Bible written about that love story. If it weren't for Rahab, there'd be no David to fight Goliath. If it weren't for Rahab, there'd be no David to bring the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. If it weren't for Rahab, there'd be no David to plan the temple that ultimately his son Solomon would build. If it weren't for Rahab, there'd be no David. There'd be no 23rd Psalm. And you understand that without a Rahab, there'd be no Joseph to believe in Mary. If it weren't for Rahab, there'd be no Joseph to raise Jesus in a loving and caring home. Now think about that just for a minute. Even though Rahab doesn't appear in Mary's family tree, her son does. And so if it weren't for Rahab, there'd be no Mary to carry the Son of God. And to think that it all began in a brothel with a woman that good, respectable people had given up on long before. But Rahab hadn't given up on Rahab, and neither had God. You see, Rahab saw beyond the present reality. Rahab could see her preferred future, and Rahab made a choice that would affect an entire nation. And without a doubt, the grace of God reached down into a most unlikely place and provided a most unlikely recipient with a new life and a great future. God was indeed painting a beautiful picture on the torn canvas of her life. And believe it or not, what God did for Rahab, he can do for you. I wonder this morning, what is it that God could do for you if you made the choice to not only believe that he's God, but to believe that he has great things for you and me to do? I wonder this morning, what is it that God could do in your life if you made the choice to believe that God has a plan and a purpose tailor-made for you? And I wonder this morning, are you willing to take that next step? Are you willing to embrace God's grace? Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you for the fact that nothing escapes your notice. Thank you that nothing ever happens that you aren't aware of. Nothing ever happens that slips out of your control. And as broken people this morning, we recognize that you are at work in our lives, bringing about changes and altering our sinful nature as only you can. And as we just take a moment and reflect on the story of Rahab, we recognize that you are at work painting a beautiful picture on the torn canvas of each of our lives. And so that we can ultimately bring praise and glory and worship to you and become the people that you intended us to become. Thank you for your word. Thank you for the promises of your word. Thank you for the work that you are doing in each of our lives. We praise you in Jesus' name.